This interview was recorded for the International Bomber Command Centre Digital Archive, which owns the copyright for this performance.
This interview is being conducted for the International Bomber Command Centre. The interviewer is Andrew Panton. The interviewee is Murray Valentine. The interview is taking place at the Office Bar in Seaford, and the date of the interview is the 31st of July, 2015.
What were your duties and responsibilities as the wireless op?
Well, receiving more than transmitting, because transmitting made you eligible to be fired at. You had headquarter mainline broadcasts made about every quarter of an hour, which told you what you were doing and gave you the exact condition of the weather when you got home. That there were broadcasts, as I say, every quarter of an hour. Also, of course, your main thing was if you were shot down and in the water, you had all facilities for transmitting and making yourself available and position at sea in a dinghy. Fortunately, I had no occasion for any of these things, but we did have one occasion when we had a fin shot off by a night fighter, and we there again did not have to make an emergency transmission. So, with all the weather reports and positionings sent to us from the mainland, you had to pick them up every quarter of an hour and pass them to the captain, so the rest of the crew knew where we were.
Were there any other duties that you were expected to do as the wireless op? Anything else you did in the aircraft?
Well, you're referring to the
Lancaster.
Yes, when we dropped the 10-tonner or the 12,000-pounder, winding in the retaining arms. If we had the Lancaster that did not have a bomb doors that closed, you just made sure the arms were retracted and the aircraft was ready to return home. I was standing above the bomb just before the bomb was released, and the next thing I was raised up and my head touched the ceiling of the Lancaster. The weight of the aircraft releasing the weight of the bomb, which caused some significant distress to most of the crew, but particularly myself, because I was standing there above open bomb doors, above the bomb as it went.
And how did the aircraft feel on takeoff? Was it any different with that huge bomb?
No, the pilots used to mention the fact that it was quite a thing to get off the ground with a heavy weight on, and you could feel the engine straining and the aircraft straining to get off the ground. But in actual fact, in the air, as far as the aircraft's movements and its aptitude, was just about the same. Well, I would say it was just like the 12,000-pounder. You took post when the bomb member went forward, or he was already forward, saying we're coming up to the bombing run. And he would give the pilot orders, left, left, right, right, steady. Bomb gone, and as it went, you suddenly found yourself in mid-air going up to the ceiling. As you returned, of course, you made an effort to get the grapplings in, so that you get back to your radio set, because time would show you have a broadcasting coming from home would be almost due, because you'd been out of your seat for a quarter of an hour almost. And then eventually you went to operational training unit. Wellingtons, where one day a pilot came up to me and said, have you got a crew? I said, no, sir. So I was flight sergeant then. He said, would you like to join me? Which I said, yes. And then we went from there to continued flying there for about 3 months on Wellingtons. And then we left there and went to Stirling's. Then we finished up the Lancaster finishing school for a fortnight. And then to a squadron.
Now, was that 61 squadron? Was that 61?
In those days it was. Skellinghawk. Just outside of Lincoln. I've been there and seen them. They've got some recollection of it all, but not much. But it was a station that did heavy bombing from Bomber Command. All those stations there, Skellingthorpe and two other three around there, just outside of Lincoln.
Was the weather ever foggy? Did you ever have to land with Fido or any of those DREM systems?
We'd be diverted back home. That's why it was important to get your quarter of an hour message, because you might be diverted. There might be clamping at Woodhorse Bar and at Skellingthorpe. And you land away, probably only for one night, two nights, to a dance in the town, jolly good.
And was that when the weather was bad at Woodhorse Bar, you'd land somewhere else?
Oh yes, you were diverted. Mm-hmm. Yes, you were diverted. And you came back to the pilot. Pilot, sir, we've just had a radio operator to pilot. We've just had a diversion. Right, thank you. Navigator to pilot, here's where you've got to steer. We're going to land at so-and-so.
Right.
Everything's all very trained.
Very, very, very trained. And the last point I wanted to ask is joining 617 Squadron. Could you say a little bit about that transfer from 61 Squadron to 617, how it happened?
Well, my pilot decided he wasn't going home because he'd had a Dear John from his fiancée of 3 years. And I had just been commissioned, so things were altering very much for me, having become an officer. And we diverted back home. That's why it was important to get your quarter of an hour message, because you might be diverted. There might be clamping at Woodhorse Bar and at Skellingthorpe. And you land away, probably only for one night, two nights, to a dance in the town, jolly good.
Transfer from 61 Squadron to 617, how it happened?
Well, my pilot decided he wasn't going home because he'd had a Dear John from his fiancée of 3 years. And I had just been commissioned, so things were altering very much for me, and become an officer. And we came back off leave and reported to the old Skellingthorpe, and we were taken by coach to Woodhorse Bar, which was quite amazing to me. All very different. However, the fact what we were going to do operationally was also going to be very, very interesting.
What were the briefings like? Can you remember anything about the briefings that you had with 617 targets?
Well, any target you went into, you try to find out from your ground crew what the bomb load was, what the petrol load was, and when you went to the, you had your briefing on radio, then you went into general briefing, and they have a blackboard and the briefing officer would stand up and say, "Gentlemen, it's going to be a long night. Hamburg." You'd hear. Or, "It's just the French coast. But whatever happens." Anyway, in Germany was always a heavy task because you were fired at all the way from the French coast into Germany, and then when you got to Germany, you really got the firing.
And once you'd had the briefing, what happened between then and getting on the aircraft?
Well, you were all thoroughly briefed and highly secure, so you were just taken to coaches outside, or I think they were coaches, and driven out to your aircraft and boarded the aircraft, and the pilot would then taxi as ordered on intercom from flight control.
Was there anybody at the caravan waving you off, or did you have a...
No, not till you came round. You were called forward, and this was done by all these lamps.
Green.
Yes. And as you'd probably be in line and taxi round, came round, the pilot would say nothing more than, "B. Baker coming forward now."
What was it like when he full throttle back and the thing went down the runway?
Quite exciting, really, because you've got a bomb load on. It's entirely different to going on a flying training trip. The pilot was like, "Right, wireless operator, blah blah blah, gunner one, gunner two, navigator." That's it, yeah. "Right, here we go then." He always used to do that, my father. "Here we go then. You feel the brakes go on. Power of the engine's revving, and then the brakes let off, and forward you go. Here we go."
How about the sound of the Merlins?
Yes, oh yes. Four of those, even with the brakes on, and the pilot would put forward his own feeling, but the engineer would hold his hands to feel, and the pilot would then let handbrake off. Away we go. "Right, gentlemen, say cheerio to everybody. Here we go," our pilot used to say. "Here we go."
How long did it usually take to get up to your operating room?
Oh, I don't know. We used to get to operational height before we really set course. So we'd be near the airfield for an hour. To get to an hour. And this. Then the navigator said, "Are you ready now?" Said, "Set 020 or whatever it was. And he says, "Right. Pilot to navigator, on course." That's it.
And did you eat or drink anything on those trips? They were long trips, weren't they?
Not really. We did have something, I can't remember what it was, but we did have a thermos flask. All this, of course, was in case you happened to ditch, bail out in the sea. If it was good, look, as they said at the briefing, it was 5 hours, 6 hours. The longest we did was to Königsberg, East Prussia, 10 hours, 25. Long trip.
And was it cold?
Not really, no. The heating used to be done by the radio operator, the heating, although people used to wear certain amount, but you didn't wear the, towards the end of the war, we weren't wearing the flying clothing they showed in the old days. Mm. The most reliable, but not particularly comfortable, was the Wellington. It was a geodetic construction. with a cloth over outside. And it's interesting to see the Bomber Command Memorial, I haven't seen it, opposite the RAF Club in Piccadilly. It's got a geodetic construction across the ceiling. And who invented the geodetic construction? Barnes Wallace. They said that many people have flown in Wellington and had accidents, and it twisted, but it didn't fall to pieces. The geodetic construction. So I met him when we were dropping the Grand Slam. For some unknown reason, I wasn't all that younger than the others. I was brought forward and introduced to him, and he said, "Take it easy, son." I said, "We have to take it easy, Mr. Wallace." And we had a bit of a chat, and that's it. Then about 20 years later, I was at Brampton. Yes, RAF Brampton. And he was there as a guest of honour with the squadron reunion. And I mentioned I hadn't met him before, and I'd like to meet him again. And I was brought forward, and I said, "Hello, Mr. Wallace. You won't remember me. I met you when we were dropping the Grand Slam." "Oh, but I do remember you." And I've told that to his daughter, and I told it to his son. And he sort of said, "Of course, Dad would. He wouldn't forget anything in principle." Mr. Lancaster, it was something I went to see one after the war at the Battle of Britain Memorial Flight. And we went to see, they have a special place to show the Lancaster, it's just got one left now, where it landed. And I went there with my father-in-law, and he said, "Murray, you've got tears in your eyes." And of course, yes, he spent a lot of time. Yes, it could be hot, it could be cold. And on occasions I looked back, I would go on an operation, take my battle dress off and have myself in shirt sleeves, regardless of the outcome if one had to leave the aircraft suddenly. One was there doing a job, and that was it.